didn't think Nora could necessarily be blamed for referring to them that way, though Julia thought it was appalling. Last summer, down the Cape, John and Maeve sat on the front lawn waiting for the two of them to arrive for the weekend. He thought that maybe he ought to explain. Bridget and Natalie lived together. And Maeve was old enough.
"Aunt Bridget and Natalie are more than friends," he said, picking at the grass.
"Special friends, I guess you would call them."
"You mean they're a couple?" she said.
"Yeah, that's it. Sometimes women love other women. Men love other men. It's sort of about the person, if that makes sense. You fall in love with a person. I know it probably sounds weird to you, but it's not weird. It's a good thing. Do you want to ask me anything about it?"
She looked at him like he was nuts.
"No."
"It's okay if you do. I know it's kind of weird."
"Dad, there are 3 lesbians in my class."
"Really? In the 7th grade?"
"Well, one of them's bi, if I had to guess."
When they reached the Dorchester exit, Maeve leaned forward and said,
"Take us by your old house, where you had to share the room."
The way she said it made sharing a room sound like a fate so cruel it might only befall an orphan out of Dickens. This annoyed him slightly, but then he had made her into the girl she was. A house teeming with people was exotic to her. They had 4 bedrooms they didn't even use. Maeve liked knowing that some summers it was John and Patrick and 6 cousins from Ireland all crowded into the front bedroom. Her favorite thing was when John said he had never been alone outside of the bathroom until the 5th grade. He didn't much feel like driving his brand new SUV into the old neighborhood, even as he loathed himself for thinking it. There was the car itself, 3 weeks old and not a scratch on it. And then there was the bumper sticker he'd gotten, which he liked at first, but now felt embarrassed about. Just 3 letters in an oval. OFD. Originally from Dorchester. When one of his clients saw the sticker, he said,
"My parents grew up there, too. Everyone loves being from Dorchester, as long as they don't actually have to live there anymore. Am I right?"
That had stuck in his craw, although it was true. John didn't want to live there. He had scrubbed every bit of Dorchester from the way he spoke. He cringed now when he heard anyone, his brothers, his cousins, pronounce potatoes, bedatus, or say, "irregardless," or, "so don't I," when they meant, "regardless, so do I." He could turn the language on and off. In some circles, the dropped R's of his childhood were a plus. But this was not the case, for the most part, in the company he kept now. He considered the sound of every syllable before it left his mouth. John had a gift for modulating his personality to suit whomever he was talking to. It seemed to him that Patrick was the same guy no matter where he went. Himself, always. He envied that. John was a shapeshifter, a pathetic pleaser, though it suited him to be this way sometimes. He owed his career to it. He turned right onto Crescent Avenue.
"There it is," he said, slowing down.
They had painted the outside, changed it from blue to white. John looked up at the corner window. He could almost see his brother beside him there, the two of them shoulder to shoulder as boys, watching a lightning storm, before things went wrong between them. A few years later, Patrick crawling out that window, tapping on it just before dawn, John sleepily crossing the room to let him in, so happy to be in on the secret. He felt wistful as they drove off. Maybe Julia could sense it. She reached over, took his hand.
Look, Maeve said.
John and Julia turned to see a Rory McLean for State Senate sign secured to someone's front porch, left over from the election 2 months ago.
That's your guy, right?
Maeve said. Yep, that's my guy.
Cool.
Maeve nodded approvingly and then retreated back into her music. John allowed himself a moment of pride with the comment. It might be months before he got such an enthusiastic response from her over anything again. 2 minutes later, they were flying down Morrissey Boulevard. When the sign for St. Ignatius Prep came into view, Julia met his eye, and he nodded. He had told her the story so many times. John was 8 years old when Patrick got in. From then on, it was his dream to attend. Maybe it was petty that he still cared so much. What happened hadn't altered the shape of his life, but it was one of those memories that stung every time, even all these years later. As a freshman, Patrick got kicked out of St. Ignatius. The next day, they sat around the breakfast table in silence until Nora said, "We didn't cross the Atlantic for this." It was a line their parents had uttered so many times, meant to shame the Rafferty children into good behavior. They, who in their unremarkable lives had gone no farther than New Hampshire, and then only to stay in a motel for their second cousin's wedding. "In fact," Charlie said, "maybe it's time for us all to go back to Ireland for good." John could never tell whether his father was joking when he said such things. "We're not going to Ireland," Nora said. "Honestly, it's that Michael Ferguson. He's a bad influence. I've said it from the start. I don't want you hanging around him anymore." Patrick rolled his eyes.
"Fergie wasn't even there, Ma."
"He didn't have to be." Patrick was enrolled in public school after that, Southie High. And though John might have expected him to get involved in the fray that came along with busing, Patrick seemed to behave himself. Until the end of his sophomore year, when there were two policemen at the door one morning. There must have been a family party that day. John remembered he was wearing a suit. His mother sent him and Bridget outside. Soon after, Nora announced that they were moving. Not to a familiar suburb, Quincy or Weymouth, but to Hull, where people they knew might go to rent a house for a week in August, but not to live. John knew the move must have something to do with Patrick, with those policemen, though he wasn't sure what. Everyone they knew lived in Dorchester. Their relatives were packed into three-deckers, piled one on top of another. They got together every weekend for parties and ran into one another on the sidewalk while out buying a quart of milk. John didn't know a single person in Hull. His older brother had ruined his life. Nora said they would adapt. They would get used to it. And they did, more or less, soon enough. John's parents seemed surprised when eighth grade came around and he reminded them that he'd be applying to St. Ignatius Prep for the fall. Whenever he'd mention the school, Patrick would make fun of him. "Why the hell would you want to go there?" So John just stopped talking about it. His application was ready to go 3 months before the deadline. John was determined to deliver it by hand, but his mother kept putting off driving him to Dorchester. Finally, she agreed to take him the day before it was due. He had chosen the clothes he would wear and everything, shined his shoes, but at the last minute, he got a stomach bug. Pat was going into town anyway. Nora said he could drop the application off to the secretary in the front office. When John protested, she raised a finger and said,
"Straight to the secretary and right back out, Patrick. Don't go any further. You've had enough trouble there."
John was nervous all day.
"What did the secretary say?"
he asked when his brother came home that night.
"Best application she's ever seen."
"Really?"
"No, she didn't say anything."
He waited and waited for a letter, a call. Months passed. Finally, his father called to see what the status was. That was when they learned that the school had never gotten his application. Charlie roared at Patrick about it. Patrick said he couldn't remember whether he'd brought the application in or not. There was no doubt in John's mind that he had done it on purpose. Pat showed no remorse. He couldn't graduate from St. Ignatius, so John wouldn't either. And maybe Nora felt this way, too. She said that either way it was no great loss.
"The bus ride from Hull would be endless," she said. "Can you imagine it, John?"
A week passed, and all she could say to him was,
"Go tell your father you're not too upset so he'll lay off your brother."
After that, John understood that his brother had never liked him. He hardened his heart to Patrick. Still, as they got older, in times of trouble, Patrick had no problem turning to him. He never asked Bridget or Brian for money. He knew they had none to give. John had co-signed leases, lent Pat thousands of dollars he knew he'd never see again. The summer John got married, Pat didn't have a car. John let him borrow his for the entire month of July while he and Julia were away on their honeymoon. Patrick got God knows how many parking tickets, which John only learned about in September, when he came out of a dinner with clients to find a boot on his Mercedes. He found a way to laugh about it. The story became a punchline. When Patrick had his windfall, he spent most of the money on the bar, but some of it he blew on stupid gestures, a fur coat for Nora, which she would never wear, a riding mower for Charlie, even though the lawn was not that big. When the Powerball went to an unprecedented $400 million, Patrick spent a grand on tickets, tossing them like confetti on Christmas Eve, wanting everyone to get in on the action. He never offered to pay John back what he owed him. Even then, John managed to stay cordial. He thought he deserved some credit for that. When Charlie got sick, John took the whole family on a trip to Ireland. He paid for them all, including Patrick, without complaint. Their most recent fight, 8 months ago, had been one of the worst. They hadn't spoken since. Of course, he felt bad about that now. He wasn't expecting Patrick to drive into a wall and die. Had he known, maybe things would have ended differently. But John would be damned if he let himself feel guilty. It had all been Patrick's fault.
"You should have compassion for him, John," Nora said. "Things haven't come so easily to him the way they have to you."
Like he had done nothing to earn his success.
"He's your brother, John."
As if brotherhood were sacrosanct. As if no matter what a brother did to you, there was no choice but to forgive and forgive and forgive. In the past year, outside of family parties, they had run into each other 3 times, once at a wake, once at a fundraiser, and then at a Red Sox game, both of them sitting right behind the dugout. John was there with clients. He had paid through the nose for the tickets. Patrick was with Fergie, many beers into the night. He had probably charmed or bribed his way to the front. What annoyed John most was that Pat always seemed to be having a hell of a lot more fun than he was. He supposed that's what your life could look like if you had no responsibilities. People John knew from Dorchester spoke of his brother with reverence. Great kid, they'd say, even now that Patrick was 50 years old. John had never been to Patrick's apartment. He double-parked in front of the address his mother had provided, a small, shabby-looking brick building. Julia offered to go in for him, but he was afraid of what she might find. "Just make sure no one taps my bumper."
"I'll fight them to the death," she said.
As he shut the car door, his phone started to vibrate in his pocket. He assumed it would be Nora, but when he pulled out the phone, he saw Rory McLean's home number.
"Rory," he said, picking up. "Your ears must be burning. I'm in Dorchester. Just saw one of your signs." "Is that right?"
Rory's tone was hesitant.
"Listen, John, I don't want to keep you. I just wanted to say that I heard about your brother. I wanted to send my condolences."
"That's kind of you. Thanks."
John noticed a woman about Pat's age smoking on the stoop. She wore a winter coat over bare legs, fluffy white slippers. She had foam curlers in her hair and sunglasses on.
"I'm not going to be able to make the wake," Rory said.
"Oh, sure. I understand."
"There's something I want to tell you," Rory said. "This is hard to say. How do I put this? I should have mentioned it sooner. When we started working together, maybe. Or, I don't know. I guess I'd be lying if I said it never crossed my mind that it could come up. But you're the best at what you do, John. I wanted the best."
"What are you talking about?" John said.
Julia was watching him from the car, confused. She gestured for him to get inside and out of the cold, like he might have forgotten why they had come.
"Patrick and I had kind of a history together," Rory said. "That thing at your country club? It wasn't totally out of nowhere. This is why I didn't want the Globe to run that story about me and Pete O'Shea, about what happened to him. The thing is, Patrick was the one who did it, who blinded him. It wasn't a robbery, John. It was a fight. I was there, too. It was right before your family moved away."
He thought of the police officers at the door. He thought of his mother suddenly hell-bent on Hall.
"Jesus," John said.
"I never blamed him," Rory said. "No one ever pressed any charges. We made up that story about a robbery to protect ourselves. We were all as guilty as sin."
"Guilty of what?"
"It was a bad situation that got out of control. Just stupid kid stuff. But I can't stop thinking about the article yesterday, wondering if he saw it. I pray it had nothing to do with..."
He stopped talking.
"I should go," John said. "But thanks for telling me. I'm glad you did."
He wasn't glad. But what the hell else could he say? John squeezed past the woman smoking on the stoop, feeling like a visitor from some other planet.
"Pardon me," he said.
Inside, it smelled like cooking, like Pam and grease and burnt toast. He followed the grubby hallway to the end, as Nora had instructed. The apartment was on the ground floor.
"Last door on the right," she'd said.
Patrick had a brown doormat with the word "Welcome" printed on it.
John wasn't sure why this should surprise him, the deep uncoolness of it. He took the key from under the mat and opened the door. He was expecting pizza boxes and beer bottles on every surface, signs of a party. But the apartment was orderly, spare. Had his mother already cleaned? On the living room wall, there was a poster of Fenway Park in a cheap plastic frame. John kept moving down the hall, into the kitchen. A sad little space with fluorescent lights, painted a cheery yellow, which somehow made it seem even sadder. He opened the fridge and found it empty, but for a half-drunk bottle of blue Gatorade. The freezer contained only vodka and three lean cuisines. He had a flash of his own house, the impressive brick facade and clean white columns, the massive lilac bushes that bloomed white in springtime. The notion that no one was to blame for Patrick's death but Patrick himself was something John had been positive of until this moment. But was he, on some level, responsible for pushing the article, for teaming up with Rory in the first place? Nora had told John to stay away. Patrick had blinded someone. John couldn't imagine his mother knowing such a thing, keeping silent all these years. She could only have known in some vague maternal sense that Pat was in trouble, that they needed to go away. He had to tell somebody. Bridget. Nora. Things haven't come so easily to him the way they have to you. It was true. Things had come easily. John followed the dim hallway until he reached the bedroom. He was the oldest now. He went to the window, pulled back the shitty blinds, and took in the sight of his girls, his world, waiting for him on the other side. Chapter 15. The story of the day Patrick was born was a hallmark of the family mythology, repeated again and again by their father. Like all Charlie's stories, it got bigger, funnier, more impressive over time. Patrick came into the world 15 minutes after they reached the hospital, the fastest birth on record at St. Margaret's. They had rushed there, Nora shouting Hail Marys all the way, Charlie running every red light. He didn't have time to buy cigars, but one of the richest men in Boston happened to be in the waiting room. Depending on the day, Charlie might claim it was the mayor, or a millionaire lawyer, or a judge. The man gave him a box of the finest Cubans. So happy was Charlie to have a son that he insisted everyone smoke them, even the nurses. Bridget's father had told this story every year on Patrick's birthday until he was gone. 5 years had passed since she last heard it. She thought of this now as they followed Nantasket Avenue all the way out to Hull, waiting for the moment when the town would appear at the tip of the peninsula, a sight she had loved since the family moved here the summer she was 10. She thought then that she had been given the greatest gift. Each day she swam until her fingers pruned, the water bitter cold. She bought a bomb pop from the ice cream truck and adored how it dripped red, white, and blue down her chin. She forgot September would come again. The extended family in Dorchester whispered about where her parents had gotten the money for the house. Bridget overheard her Uncle Jack say that Charlie won it gambling. The neighbors downstairs, who were distant cousins, believed they had been cheated out of some phantom inheritance. Charlie said they had simply saved well. But Bridget and John suspected Aunt Kitty had been the one to help their parents. In the early 70s,
Her long-estranged husband died of a sudden heart attack while out jogging. They had never divorced. Kitty inherited all his money. Bridget was told that the man had died before she had ever been told he existed. Maybe it explained why it felt as if Kitty was their responsibility. Nora acted indebted to her, taking her advice, or at least pretending to. Charlie did everything for his sister that a husband ought to do, usually before he did it at his own house, the raking and the shoveling and the repairs. Nora never complained. In recent years, she had cared for Kitty, bringing her groceries and oversized bottles of wine, shuttling her to appointments at the hospital and the hair salon. Hull was a summer town. Most of the cottages on the bay weren't even insulated. 9 months a year, only every third house was occupied. On a gray winter day, it could feel bleak, depressing. Today, this seemed right, given the occasion. They had buried her father on a glorious sunny morning, a backdrop that felt almost vulgar at the time. Bridget tensed as Natalie swerved a hair over the yellow line and ever so slightly into the oncoming lane before correcting herself. She wasn't used to driving the van. Wasn't used to driving at all. Usually Bridget did it. But today Natalie had insisted. "You were up all night, sweetie. You need to rest." Never mind that she had been up, too. When Charlie died, Bridget came alone, her hands shaking the whole way. She had to pull over 4 or 5 times. It was such a comfort having Natalie beside her. They passed Ahern's Bakery, and Bridget noted the rainbow flag flying out front. It had been there a few years now. Marie Ahern's parents owned the bakery. She was the first girl Bridget ever kissed. Bridget knew from Facebook that Marie came out to her enormous Catholic family years ago, and it went like a dream. The Ahearns had adapted. After college, Marie moved in with a woman she met working at State Street Bank. They got married. Marie's mother made them a 3-tiered wedding cake with 2 marzipan brides on top. Now they had a house in Newburyport, and a 20-foot blow-up of Pat Patriot, which they inflated and displayed on their front lawn on game days. If anyone had told Bridget when she was young that Massachusetts would be the first state in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage, she never would have believed it. The world had opened up in ways she hadn't seen coming. But her family had not. They all knew Bridget was gay, with the possible exception of Nora. It was something her brothers accepted, but they didn't celebrate it, or even talk about it much. Sometimes she wished this age of openness hadn't come when she herself was still locked in some fundamental way. Maybe it would have been better, easier, if people just agreed to keep their sexuality to themselves. Natalie would think Bridget was deranged if she said it out loud. They were about to bring a child into the world. The child, a boy, she was already sure of it, would see them as they could see their own parents, from so close up. It made her desperate to find a way to be better now, before he arrived. She realized they had missed the turnoff. "Bang a yui," Bridget said. Natalie gave her a surprised grin. "Excuse me?" "Turn around." "I like when your Boston comes out." Bridget smiled. As a kid, she never would have believed that she'd leave. Even after she did, New York wasn't supposed to be forever. There was a constant pull toward home. Every time she heard the church bells ring in her neighborhood in Brooklyn, she thought of Nora. On a nice afternoon in spring, she might think of the crowds at Fenway Park, how the opening notes of Dirty Water put a lump in her throat. But Bridget had accepted that she could never move back here for good, even if she wanted to. She had put it from her mind. A minute into town, Natalie slowed to a stop at a red light. Nantasket Beach was on their right. Once, Paragon Park had stood on the other side of the road, running parallel to the water, the horizon eclipsed by a white roller coaster. From its highest peak, you could see the city skyline in the distance. Now the park was gone, condos put up in its place. Only the carousel and the penny arcade remained, as if to assure you that you hadn't dreamed it all. Amazing how the people and places that once mattered most would vanish, and still you carried on. When they first decided to use a sperm donor, Natalie asked if Bridget thought one of her brothers might want to do it. "Then the baby would be related to us both," she said. "Dear God, no," Bridget said. The thought of having such a conversation with any of her brothers was unfathomable. But now, part of her wished they had asked Patrick. He was the handsomest of all the boys. For the rest of her life, she might have gotten to see his face smiling back at her, instead of the face of International Archaeologist number 4592. They reached Peachtree Street, and Natalie accelerated up the hill, making them both jolt backward. "Sorry," she said. "Take it easy there, Leadfoot." When they got to the house, she parked the van behind Nora's car in the driveway. "Let me just call the shelter and check in," Bridget said, reaching for her cell phone in the cup holder. Natalie put a hand on her hand. "I'm sure Michelle's got it under control," she said. "Bridget, just be here." She nodded. They got out. A brand new SUV Bridget didn't recognize sat at the curb. On the back of the SUV, a BMW, was an oval-shaped bumper sticker that contained the letters OFD, originally from Dorchester. "Oh, Jesus, John," she said. She supposed he had to be seen in Boston, had to defend the idea that he loved Dorchester so damn much, but chose to live in Weston, chose to send his daughter to some pretentious prep school. Still, Bridget would have to give him shit for it. It was all that he deserved. She unloaded the bags from the back as Natalie led the dog up the front steps. Bridget followed, thinking of how she would walk right into Natalie's parents' house, a member of the family. But here, Natalie, her friendly, outgoing Natalie, waited to be let in. When Bridget opened the door, Rocco raced toward the kitchen, leash trailing behind. They could hear low voices down the hall. "Are you ready?" Natalie said. "No," Bridget said. "Let's go home." From a stand in the corner, the infant of Prague stared at them. The statue wore a red satin robe, a sky blue crown. It had been decapitated countless times over the years by hockey sticks and flying elbows. Nora always dutifully glued the head back on. Bridget dropped the bags in front of Julia and John's enormous wedding portrait. A friend of their cousin's, a crime scene photographer with the Boston Police Department, had taken all the pictures that day. He gave them a terrific deal, but he had no idea how to take a photo of a living human being. The shots were stiff and posed, or else he only managed to capture a shoe, an elbow. She hung their coats, and then they followed the dog into the kitchen. Brian was leaning against the counter in his suit, staring off into space, his eyes glassy. Wasted or crying, she couldn't tell. There were 3 empty beer bottles lined up behind him, and a fresh one in his hand. Whenever Bridget pictured him, he was still in peak shape, all muscle, the body of an athlete. It took her by surprise to be reminded that he had let himself get kind of fat. The sight of that double chin, the paunch beneath his shirt, depressed her. John and Maeve sat at the table, each looking at a cell phone screen. Julia was bent in front of the fridge, trying to jam a large platter into it. She sighed and tried the freezer, exposing several quarts of Brigham's vanilla ice cream, Nora's only vice. "Hey," Brian said, bending to rub Rocco's cheek. "Hi," Bridget said. She wanted to ask if he was all right. He and Patrick were so close. But Brian never said much, and Bridget didn't know where to start, not with everyone standing around. "How was the drive?" Julia said. "We just got here ourselves." She came over and hugged Natalie, and then Bridget. Bridget stood limp in her arms. As a rule, the Raffertys were not huggers. Her sister-in-law looked perfect, as usual. She wore heels over black stockings. Her dress seemed like just a plain black dress to Bridget, but later Natalie would tell her who had made it, what it cost. Bridget had always thought of Julia as low-key, thrifty. She was forever bragging to Nora about deals she had scored while shopping. But when Natalie first met them at a casual backyard barbecue, she took one look at Julia and whispered, "I can't believe she's playing volleyball in those sandals." "Why not?" Bridget said. "They cost $1,200. The information was like a firecracker in her pocket that she might choose to light up at any moment, making her mother's head explode. Maeve came and hugged them now, too. "Dad, come on," she said. "Give Aunt Bridget a hug." John made a grudging show of getting up, ambling toward her. They pretended to recoil from each other.
"God, you people," Maeve said.
Bridget smiled. She felt something crack open in her when she and John embraced. She started to cry. Her stupid brother, the big idiot, her companion through this life. She had always felt safest with him. John looked so sad when they pulled apart. She couldn't stand the look on his face. "New car?" Bridget said.
"Yeah. Nice, huh?"
"Oh, yeah.
Cool bumper sticker, too. Though wouldn't it be more efficient just to tape a sign to the window that says, 'I'm a douche, please slash my tires'?"
Brian snorted, beer bubbling out of his nose.
"Fuck off," John said with a smile.
"Dad," Maeve said, "pay up."
She charged them $5 for the F word, as she called it, and $1 for everything else. She cleaned up at Rafferty family functions. She had once told Bridget that she'd never made a cent off Julia's side.
"Put it on my tab," John said.
Maeve looked like she might protest, but instead she returned to her phone. John had given Maeve a Claddagh ring to match his own when she was 10. She had worn it ever since. But Bridget noticed now that the ring was no longer on her finger. Recently, Maeve had texted Bridget, "I feel like my parents don't want me to be Chinese. Not really." Bridget texted right back, wanting to pick up the phone and call, but knowing it was unlikely that Maeve would answer. Maeve conducted all serious conversations over text. Bridget said she didn't think it was true. She reminded Maeve how John and Julia had kept in touch with some of the families who adopted at the same time they did. They got the girls together every year. She told her niece that if she were their biological child, there would have been other issues. No girl felt like she belonged in her family at 13.
Talk to them about it, she said.
Privately, she thought there were things John and Julia might have done differently. Natalie agreed. They themselves would have handled the situation with more sensitivity. It was so nice to be on the cusp of parenthood, to be able to judge other people's choices with confidence, not yet having made any mistakes of their own. When Charlie was still alive, he and John were always talking to Maeve about Irish pride. They told her she was Chirish, Chinese and Irish. But no one ever said two words about China. She was the only child of her generation in the family. Nora and Charlie had expected a dozen grandkids, but instead they just had Maeve to carry on the legacy. Even her name had been chosen for this reason. Julia resisted at first. She thought it was a ridiculous name to saddle her with, Maeve Rafferty. For the rest of her life, every job interview she ever went to, they'd be expecting a freckle-faced redhead to walk through the door. Bridget remembered Maeve in second grade, assigned to write about her ancestry for school. The family had gathered at her mother's house for dinner. Charlie was already sick then, with only a few months left. Still, he was as exuberant as ever, looking over the family tree of Raffertys and Flynns Maeve had created on a green poster board. It seemed odd to Bridget then that Maeve knew nothing about the family she was born to, not even the woman who gave birth to her. But she could rattle off the names of her great-great-grandparents on both Charlie's and Nora's sides. She wondered if Maeve ever thought about it. Maeve had prepared a list of questions for them about life in Ireland. Nora never spoke about the past, so they all turned to Charlie, even when Maeve said, "What did girls wear to school where you grew up?"
"They wore a uniform," Charlie said, looking to Nora to complete the thought.
Nora sighed, as if it were a great effort to tell them. "A jumper and a skirt, navy blue. We never wore navy after that."
"What did you do on your birthday and at Christmas to celebrate?"
"Birthdays just came and they went," Nora said. "At Christmas we might get a doll or a holy picture, which was a real novelty then. We were reared very plainly. Our parents were strict, but we never knew the difference, not at all."
It came out as one word when she said it. "Not at all."
Even this amount of candor from her mother surprised Bridget. Perhaps she was willing to talk about Ireland now because it was for school, or because she was sweeter with Maeve than she was with the rest of them. Or maybe spending her days tending to a dying husband made reminiscing seem a more appealing distraction than it otherwise might.
"There was no such thing as anything going to happen to us," Nora continued. "At 6 or 8, I'd take my brother to the sea alone. But it was a hard life. None of the pampering and the presents you're used to. Children were put to work."
"Did you get an allowance at least?" Maeve asked.
"Heavens no! An allowance!" Nora said it as if an allowance were a baby giraffe or a Lamborghini. "In the town we came from, they didn't get electricity until the early 60s, she said. "Even then there was just one plug in the kitchen. It took another 10 years before you had them in every room. And no one had telephones until 1984. My best friend, Una Donnelly, was the first to have one. People lined up on a Sunday at her front door to make a call. Of course, 2 years after that, the knitwear factory in town closed. A shock to everyone. Poor Una lost her job. Lots of people had to move away. They went off to Shannon or Limerick or London."
"Jesus," John said. "Isn't there anything positive you can tell her?"
Charlie cleared his throat.
Maeve, we come from the west of Ireland. Cromwell drove us there. To hell or to Connacht, he said. The ones who survived were made from the toughest stuff. Those were our people, your people.
They had all heard it a million times.
He makes it sound very grand, Nora said, but we were both raised on filthy farms, for heaven's sake.
Impossible to picture it, knowing Nora as they did, as a woman with a four-bedroom house, wall-to-wall carpeting, a woman who hated dust and dirt and counted frozen vegetables among man's greatest inventions.
You can put this in your report, Charlie said. Your grandmother was so courageous that she came to America all by herself, at 21, alone completely.
Bridget's mother was giving Charlie the deep frown she made in response to half the things he said. Bridget hadn't ever thought of it before, but it was remarkable.
What was it like, Nana? Maeve said.
Nora forced a smile. I met other girls. We danced and sang the whole way here. We had a grand time. There was even a swimming pool on the ship.
Bridget saw her father light up, the face he made when it was time to turn from serious to joking.
It wasn't so easy for my lot, he said. We were in steerage, beneath all the rich people. There were rats and dead bodies in the hold. One day, the boat took on water. We knew we were going down. I peeked into a doorway, and there was this little old Irish couple hugging in their bed, waiting for death to take them home to Jesus.
Dad, shut up. You're reciting the plot of Titanic, John said.
Was I? Charlie said. He gave Maeve a wink.
Maeve and I have a little announcement, John said. Do you want to tell them?
Maeve nodded vigorously.
We got a brick at Ellis Island, she said.
A brick? Bridget said. If you donate a certain amount, they put a brick in the walkway with your family name on it to commemorate relatives who came through there, John said. As of next week, the Raffertys will get their very own brick. We'll put a picture of it in Maeve's report.
Nora and Charlie were silent.
What? John said.
It's very nice, Nora said to Maeve.
But no one in our family went to Ellis Island, Charlie said.
What?
John said.
You said you came through New York.
We did, but Ellis Island was closed by the time we got there.
All right. But what about all your relatives who came over at the turn of the century?
They came straight to Massachusetts, Charlie said. New Bedford, and a few through Taunton.
John's face sank.
Taunton, he said. That's not very exciting.
Charlie pretended to hear a voice from inside the wall.
Your ancestors say they're sorry to disappoint you.
When Nora walked into the kitchen, her view of Natalie was temporarily blocked by the open refrigerator door. Natalie had joined forces with Julia, the two of them trying to fit two large platters into an overstuffed fridge.
Julia, what on earth are you doing? Nora said.
Bridget, you're not dressed.
Hi, Mom, Bridget said.
John, did you get it? Nora said.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out something tiny.
Is this the right one?
Nora squinted and went up close.
Yes, she said. Oh, thank God. Before we go, I need to talk to you all.
Natalie stood to her full height now. Nora regarded her as if she were a stranger selling encyclopedias door to door.
Oh, she said. Hello.
Hi, Nora, Natalie said. I'm so, so sorry. How are you?
Bridget's mother looked about 1,000 years old in her black skirt suit. She wasn't wearing her usual pink lipstick. Without it, you could see how terribly thin her lips had gotten. Or maybe they were always that way underneath. "I brought some appetizers for later," Julia said. "I'm just trying to make room."
"I wish I hadn't done that," Nora said.
"Carefully you don't let all the cold air out. The neighbors keep dropping things off. They think we're going to starve. Eileen brought enough for an army."
"Oh, Bridget. Tommy will be there tonight. His divorce is final now, but don't say anything."
There was a shift in the room's energy. Julia gave Natalie a sympathetic shake of the head.
"Mom," John said, "who cares about Tommy Delaney?"
He looked flabbergasted. Bridget loved him for that look. She felt a sudden urge to escape.
"I should iron my shirt," she said. She looked at Natalie. "I'll just be a minute."
Bridget felt bad leaving her there, but her stomach tightened and didn't unclench until she had the shirt in hand and was descending the basement stairs toward the ironing board beside the washing machine. Nora had a yard sale after someone in the family died and donated what she could to the Morgan Memorial. Whatever was left ended up down here, as if maybe, even though she literally could not give it away, somebody might want it someday. The ping-pong table was heaped with relics. It had buckled in the center around the net, where enormous Tupperware bins were stacked, all filled. A stranger's smiling face in an old photograph was pressed against the side of one bin, like the poor woman was trying to escape. You could tell she was at a party, her head thrown back in laughter. Nora's own relatives back in Ireland were long dead. The family in America was Charlie's, but she took care of them all, visiting them in the hospital in their old age, and later handling the details of their deaths. If someone hadn't saved for a proper funeral, Nora and Charlie paid. One long-lost great-uncle in Seattle, to whom nobody had spoken since 1967, was flown back to Boston and laid to rest for all eternity with the very Rafferty clan he had gone to great lengths to escape in life.
"That'll show you, Seamus," Charlie said at the burial.
As she waited for the iron to heat up, Bridget poked through the odd container. A box that once held ice skates now overflowed with black and white pictures curling in at the edges. The lid on a lobster pot could be lifted to expose a naked doll, a red magic marker wound slashed along one arm, and a bright blue ball glove, the tag still on. Her father had gotten the glove on sale at Calder. John pointed out that it was for a lefty. None of them could use it, but Charlie's enthusiasm was undiminished. It was marked down 70%. Bridget replaced the lid now. She told herself not to look any further and went to do the ironing. Snooping around down here once when she was 12 or so, she had found what seemed to be a love letter at the bottom of a shoebox, addressed to her mother.
"No one can know about what we've done," it said. "My wife couldn't bear it, nor your husband, I would imagine."
Bridget showed the note to John, but they never discussed it again. It was the kind of thing that disturbed you so thoroughly, you had no choice but to put it out of your head and go on. She only thought of it every now and then, a quick, unpleasant zap of recognition. Why did people save what they didn't want found? Maybe because you never dreamed you'd actually die. There was always time to get rid of your ghosts. When Bridget returned to the kitchen, everyone had retreated to his or her separate corner, but for Brian, who sat alone drinking a beer, lost in thought.
She walked on and found John coming down the stairs.
"Hey," he whispered. "I have to tell you something. Don't say anything to Mom."
He paused, and it was as if they were 10 again, him waiting for her to swear on a stack of Bibles. Bridget nodded.
"What?"
"Rory McLean called me a little while ago, and..." The look of concern on his face morphed into a huge smile. Bridget turned to see Maeve standing behind her.
"Hey, kiddo,"
she said. Maeve gave her a salute.
"Bookmark that for later," John said.
"Bookmark what?"
Maeve said.
"Just something about,"
John said, and Bridget could see the wheels turning.
"The stock market."
Maeve sighed.
"Sure."
"Later then," Bridget said, and carried on to her bedroom where Natalie stood, hanging their clothes.
"Hi," Bridget said. She could tell from Natalie's expression that she wasn't happy. "I'm sorry for leaving you alone with the crazies."
There was a long silence, and then Natalie said, "Look, I know it's a hard time, but I feel like we're so close to doing the whole parent thing, really doing it. And then I get a reception like that from your mother, and then you just flee. You have a sudden need to iron? It makes me feel like I'm kidding myself."
Bridget regarded Natalie, the one person who had accepted her in all her oddness, all her sorrow. Something fell away.
"Okay, I'm going to tell her about the baby right now."
Natalie widened her eyes.
"Now?"
"Yes, right now."
Bridget kissed her and then turned on her heel, the freshly ironed shirt still slung over her shoulder.
She found Nora sitting alone in the living room, waiting for the rest of them to be ready.
"Mom," she said, "can we talk a minute?"
"Yes," Nora said. "I want to talk to you, too. Come and sit. There's something we should discuss. I wanted to tell all of you at once, but you're never together."
They had all been together 15 minutes ago. Bridget thought of her mother's performance in the kitchen and wondered if Natalie's presence had stopped her from saying whatever it was she wanted to say. Bridget sat on the sofa beside her. She was overtaken by a fear that her mother somehow knew already. She would try to talk Bridget out of the baby, poison her mind against the whole idea. Of course, it would seem terribly odd to her, just as it had when John and Julia announced they were adopting. Nora wouldn't get to have any uncomplicated grandchildren. It had all been so easy for her generation. There was nothing to think about then. They got married, they had babies the old-fashioned way, the end.
"There might be a nun at the wake," Nora said.
"That's what you wanted to tell me?"
Her mother nodded. Bridget rolled her shoulders back. Nora bringing up the idea of a baby, she realized, was not her fear, but her fantasy, that her mother might see her as she was.
"Anyway," Bridget said. She searched for a way in. How could it be so hard to say this? "I was thinking about you, and when you first became a mother, it must have been difficult for you."
She thought Nora looked almost suspicious.
"What do you mean by that?"
"Well, just that you were in a new country. You didn't have your own mother to help you. If a woman has her mother on her side, then..."
"My mother died when I was a child," Nora said, as if Bridget might not know.
"Right."
She was making a mess of this.
"I just meant you must have missed her then. You never talked about her much."
"I never had a lot of time to think about it," Nora said. "I suppose that was a good thing."
"Maybe. I've been thinking a lot about mothers and daughters.
Well, mothers and babies, I guess. Because Nora looked annoyed.